The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and tonight we're going to talk about entrepreneurship around the globe. My first guest will be Linda Rotenberg, the founder and CEO of Endeavor Global. About 20 years ago, she observed that young, bright people in places like Argentina wanted government jobs, because the idea of starting your own business was simply unthinkable.
I was like, the government again. Why aren't you becoming, and I couldn't think of the word entrepreneur in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And we went back and forth, and it turns out there wasn't one, because empresario meant a big business leader with government connections and Swiss bank accounts. And I thought, wow, no wonder no one is becoming an entrepreneur. They don't even have a word to tell their mom, you know, what they're going to be.
And then you will hear from Kenneth Dudek, the executive director of Fountain House. They believe that one of the most effective therapies for mental illness is community.
To me, the biggest problem for people with serious mental illness in this day and age is isolation. Mm. That what happens to people is that they live in the community, but they are really totally isolated from the community, and that's not a good thing.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, March 25th. A motor neuron disease charity in the UK said an influx of donations and visitors to its website following the death of Stephen Hawking caused it to crash, and it could not cope with the overwhelming demand. Google has announced a commitment of $300 million over 3 years to address fake news and support quality journalism in the digital age. The Mayo Clinic announced it had raised $3.76 billion during a drive that began in January 2010. The campaign exceeded its $3 billion goal 1 year early. Starbucks has announced a $10 million commitment in support of efforts to develop a disposable cup that can be recycled or composted. And finally, the total cost of paid care for people living with Alzheimer's and other types of dementia is projected to reach $277 billion in 2018, a report from the Alzheimer's Association finds. The report also found that 5.7 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's, including 5.5 million people over age 65. That's 10% of all older adults. By 2025, that number is projected to reach $7.1 million. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday night. I'll be back to speak with Linda Rotenberg right after this.
You probably know Sesame Street as the TV show that taught you letters and numbers. But Sesame is so much more. Sesame Workshop is a nonprofit with a mission to help all children grow smarter, stronger, and kinder. Big Bird wants to help, so he started the Yellow Feather Fund to bring education to children in need. You can help too. Visit yellowfeatherfund.org to learn more or make a donation. That's yellowfeatherfund.org.
Welcome back to The Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
So how would you like to take on this challenge? Go out and create an ecosystem for entrepreneurs to raise money, be mentored, hire talent, and start a business in emerging countries, and do this at a time when there wasn't even a word for entrepreneur in many of those nations. Sounds like a fool's errand, doesn't it? Something that a person would have to be a little crazy to tackle. But that is exactly what my next guest did. She is Linda Rotenberg, the founder and CEO of Endeavor Global and the author of Crazy as a Compliment. Good evening, Linda, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Great to be here.
Having had a hand in helping launch so many enterprises over 20 years or so, you're probably familiar with a lot of origin stories of many of them. But what is the founding story of yours, Endeavor Global?
Well, that would go back to the mid-90s when I was basically a refugee from the law. I graduated from law school and had no interest in practicing, and found my way to Latin America and was living in Buenos Aires. And this was the mid-1990s. Mm-hmm. And in Argentina, every young person I was meeting said they wanted a government job. And I thought, really? You want to work for the government? And meanwhile, back at home in the U.S., it was the era of Netscape and Yahoo and Steve Jobs coming back to Apple.
Exciting times.
And I kept telling people, well, why don't you want to be an entrepreneur? And they'd say, what? And my aha moment came in a taxi ride when I learned my driver had an engineering degree. And I thought, okay, this guy.
Found my guy.
And when I talked to him, he said, no, I'm driving a taxi because government won't hire me. I was like, the government again. Why aren't you becoming? And I couldn't think of the word entrepreneur in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And we went back and forth. And it turns out there wasn't one because empresario meant a big business leader with government connections and Swiss bank accounts. And I thought, wow, no wonder no one is becoming an entrepreneur. They don't even have a word to tell their mom, you know, what they're going to be. And it turned out that you could get $100 microcredit loan at the time or $100 million investment if you were one of the top wealthiest families. But if you were just a person with some idea but no real connections, there was nowhere to turn for help. So that was my aha moment. And I went back to the U.S. to tell my parents. And first I met
I'm sure they were thrilled.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the story is this other – I kept being put in touch with this other crazy kid named Peter Kellner. And the two of us met in my parents' kitchen to devise the business plan for what would become Endeavor. And, yes, as you surmised, my parents were not thrilled.
No, absolutely not. Not after all that schooling.
Exactly. Yeah, you know,
that was your crazy moment.
That was. And it was, you know, when my parents thought I was going to go to Goldman Sachs, if not practice law, that seemed crazy. And when I started this business plan, literally on a napkin, as cliche as it might be, it's really true, with Peter to devise a support network for the would-be entrepreneurs and talent in emerging countries, they did not think this was a way to get a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
Or my mother was particularly worried that I was going to get on all these planes and never produce grandchildren for her. So this was before egg freezing, I guess. So I call this my kitchen table moment because I feel like a lot of entrepreneurs go through this.
Yeah.
When they have to make a decision, do I take the safe and known path? Or do I veer to the, you know, unexpected and unknown? And I kind of believe that entrepreneurs in their gut know that they have to pursue this idea. No matter how crazy it may sound to other people,
mm-hmm.
they believe they have to. And that's what happened to me.
Well, that's fantastic. And you literally began this on the back of a napkin. Now, you mentioned a moment ago Steve Jobs and Mark Andreessen of Netscape and I guess Bill Gates. None of them really relate, though, to Central and South America. Did you have to find yourself a person, a role model down there to really create the belief that this could be done?
I did. You exactly are right. That was our first objective. We said we have to create an accessible role model because people had been telling me I was in Brazil and told the story of Steve Jobs and Apple Computer and the start. And he said, Linda, how does this relate to my life? You know, I don't even have a garage. So I thought, okay, that the Silicon Valley stories in the garage are not going to be applicable. And so one of the first people we met was sheep farmer from Patagonia named Wences Casares. And Wences was 24 years old, had already started a series of businesses, and we met him when he had the idea for what he was calling the E-Trade of Latin America, Patagon.com.
Mm-hmm.
And no one understood what E-Trade was. No one understood why he wanted to take on the financial system, you know, in his country. And we just saw a kid with passion and fire in his eyes and the ability to execute because he'd done it several times before, though he was only 24. So we put him through Endeavor's screening process. He becomes an Endeavor entrepreneur. We help him raise capital from Fred Wilson, who now runs Union Square Ventures,
yeah.
and a woman named Susan Siegel, who was at Chase Capital. So help him raise capital, help find him a COO. Wences ended up marrying my assistant, Belle, so he got the full service Endeavor.
I bet.
And 18 months later, he sells Patagon.com, which 34 local investors had turned him down mm-hmm. because they thought this idea would never work. He sells it to Banco Santander for $750 million.
Oh, my.
And a few things happen. One is all 34 investors call me up and say, Linda, you got another, you know, kid
anybody
with
else?
Yeah, exactly, with a crazy idea. I'm interested now. And all these young people, and to this day, 20 years later, say, if Wences can do it, I can too.
Yeah.
Because here's a kid who grew up literally on a sheep farm,
mm-hmm.
did not come from, you know, the wealthy background with a last name that meant, you know, he had all the connections. And yet here he was pursuing his idea and able to succeed. And what's wonderful is today, Wentz is actually now runs a company called Zappo. It's one of the major Bitcoin platforms in the world. I think 5% of the world's Bitcoin goes through Zappo's vaults.
So he's still at it.
He's still at it. And he's also mentoring, angel investing, telling his story. And so what we've seen through Wentz is really how an ecosystem builds. And if you can find a few examples who give people encouragement and who also pay it forward into the ecosystem, that's really how things change.
Yeah, that's really part of your model. Well, let's talk a little bit about Endeavor Global and how you go about your business. Number one, how do you choose what countries to operate in?
Well, we had a very simple idea going in, which was that we were going to be pulled into countries by the local private sector rather than push our ideas onto countries. One of my problems with the way global philanthropy is done is oftentimes people in the United States land in a country and say, hello, we're here to solve your problems that you didn't know exist. And I didn't want that. I wanted it to be a partnership. Endeavor's about entrepreneurship. It's about markets. It's about demand. And so we said, let's go where the private sector pulls us in and says, we need entrepreneurs in our country. Can you help us together as a partner? And so that's what we've done. We're now in 30 countries around the world, and that's how our model still operates today.
How do you identify these high-impact entrepreneurs? Is there a method or a process that you put them through to choose them?
There's a very rigorous process.
I suspected there might be.
So, look, once we form a board in every local country, we hire a management team. Endeavor today has 550 full-time staff around the world. So our local boards and management teams start scouring the local ecosystems for people who have not just a kernel of an idea, but actually started something and are at an inflection point where they want to scale. Endeavor, which I'm sure we'll get into, is all about the scale up rather than the startup. So we're agnostic in terms of the industry. We have people tackling health tech and ed tech and fintech and traditional manufacturing and food and beverage, all scalable for-profit models. And we put them through a local screening. And then now 8 times a year, we have the World Cup of Entrepreneurship, where entrepreneurs come from all over the world. We just held one in Dubai. We're about to hold one in the Philippines and then in Louisville, Kentucky, where experts in venture capital, entrepreneurship, come and judge the final candidates. And they have to unanimously select the Endeavor entrepreneurs. So I always say it's sort of Shark Tank meets the movie 12 Angry Men, where one juror can hold out, or women. That's how we. And then everyone who passes through that process and becomes an Endeavor entrepreneur, it really comes with that seal of approval.
Yeah. Well, what if I pass through that process? What does Endeavor do for me? How do you support these entrepreneurs?
Well, we now give people access to advisory boards and mentors from around the world. We have industry clusters now. So we just had all of the health tech and healthcare entrepreneurs meet with experts in their field. We held another for the food and beverage companies, another for the software as a service companies. So you get to meet experts in your field and a peer network. We find now what's so interesting is the entrepreneurs are learning so much from one another. And it's scary oftentimes to be alone in your ecosystem. You can't tell your parents you're about to go bankrupt. You can't tell your employees that you're having challenges. You don't want to tell your venture capitalists if you've raised capital. So who do you go to? So Endeavor really becomes that support system. We also now have a co-investment fund where we'll help our entrepreneurs not only raise the capital, but participate in their funding rounds.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, your funding round, I think, was Endeavor 2 Catalyst Fund. Who are your investors?
We have individuals from all around the world. We have great entrepreneurs from Michael Dell and Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn to some of our own successful entrepreneurs like Wences. Who we just
mentioned. Paying it forward.
And it's $115 million, two co-investment funds. We've made now over 75 co-investments in our entrepreneurs. So entrepreneurs that get selected by Endeavor know that anytime they raise a round of financing, Endeavor will come in at 10% of their rounds.
Let's get to the scale and scope of this. You mentioned 30 countries, but how many entrepreneurs have you supported? How many jobs has that created? What are the annual revenues?
Great. So we started in Latin America, but now our latest country was just Endeavor Nigeria. We operate throughout the Middle East, Southeast Asia, Europe, Africa, Latin America, and now the United States as well, which I'm sure we will get into.
Mm-hmm.
We have screened over 55,000 entrepreneurs and selected just under 1,700 entrepreneurs from about 1,000 companies. And today, those entrepreneurs are generating $15 billion annually, and they've created over 1.5 million jobs.
That is incredibly impressive. Let me take a step back, Linda, to that word we mentioned a moment ago, entrepreneur. You know, that has been bantered about so much in the last few years that I don't think that people even know what it means. What does it mean to you?
Well, to me, an entrepreneur is someone who spots a pain point or an opportunity and feels like they have a solution to solve that problem, and then relentlessly goes after that and gives themselves permission to pursue what everyone else thinks is a crazy idea. Because my motto is not only that crazy is a compliment, but if when you're starting out, you're not called crazy, it means you're not thinking big enough.
Yeah, exactly right. I think it was Reed who said that if you prototype a product in Silicon Valley and you introduce that product and people don't laugh at you, you've waited too long.
Exactly.
That spirit.
But I think for me, the pain points are important because I think that one of the things working with entrepreneurs outside the United States, I've seen they're solving real problems. So they're solving the problem of, you know, people are dying in emergency rooms because there's no computerized records. How do you solve that problem? How do you solve the problem that millions of kids aren't getting access to education? What can technology do to solve that problem? How do you solve the problem that people don't have access to bank accounts? There are very few credit cards outside the United States. How do you bank the unbanked? And doing these through these scalable models, but they're actually trying to improve real people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that versus trying to reverse engineer the next app.
Right. For sure. Well, you have identified a number of strategies that you can believe help any budding entrepreneur. And I want you to share several with us, starting with maybe my favorite, be a stalker. What do you mean by that?
Well, everyone says, well, how did you get your first funding, Linda? And I was known as Chica Loca, the crazy girl, right? Here I am, assuming that there are these entrepreneurs with ideas that can go to scale in places like, you know, Argentina and Brazil and later in Turkey and Indonesia. No one thought this was possible. So how did I even get my funding? Well, I stalked people. I saw them on airplanes. Can't really escape an airplane or at the gym on treadmills. And I would very nicely go up and explain my idea, but in usually a confined space where they couldn't get away. And I do it with a smile. But I joke that stalking is an underrated startup strategy because really the idea is that so many people are afraid to go up and share their idea. So many people, even at conferences I see, particularly women, are afraid to give that business card. They don't want to seem pushy. And so what I say, obviously I'm joking. You should be a very cautious stalker.
Yeah, yeah.
But the point is, share your passion, share your idea. So what if the person turns you down? You never know who actually will say, I'd love to learn more.
Only takes one sometimes. And, you know, they have such gatekeepers very often to get to them. It sometimes is your only opportunity
exactly.
to get that face to face.
My best technique is when you go to a conference, don't run up to someone after their speech when 100 other people do.
Right.
Wait for them to go to the bathroom.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wait outside, not inside, but outside.
That's a good idea. That's right. Take down the do not loiter sign
exactly.
and just wait there. How do entrepreneurs think about risk?
This is a question. I think it's a myth that entrepreneurs are these swashbuckling, you know, risk takers who go for broke. I see entrepreneurs as risk minimizers, not risk maximizers. They don't think what they're doing is risky. Everybody else may. So I think that, to me, the biggest risk today is taking no risk at all.
Mm.
I think our jobs are no longer safe. Our corporations are no longer safe. And so if we just keep doing our same job and put our head down and, you know, or in the sand, we're going to risk being disintermediated, for lack of a better word, right? I think taking some amount of risk, but then being very cautious about how and getting information on whether things are working and testing things, to me, that's not risky at all, but it's perceived as risk.
Mm-hmm. You know, most entrepreneurs, when we think about them, we're thinking about that proverbial garage or that dorm room. But in your book and among other places, you really talk about the all-important scale-up phase. What are some of the keys to successfully growing a business?
You know, I think people do equate entrepreneurship with startups. And I love startups. But the reality is that people focus so much on the business plans. Most entrepreneurs I work with never even had a business plan. You know, they just get going. I'm like, stop planning, start doing. The challenge actually for many of them, after they give themselves permission, to me, giving yourself permission to launch your crazy idea is the hardest thing. Mm. After that, you know, testing things in the marketplace today with things like Kickstarter and GoFundMe, you don't really need a lot of outside capital. You can put something online and see if it gets traction. So to me, the scale-up phase is where the interesting things start to happen. And a lot of this has to do with people's growth as leaders, right? And it's one thing when you're convincing a few people to go with you on this journey. But what happens when people have paychecks?
Mm-hmm.
And now you have to, you know, feed a number of mouths. You're growing. You have to change as a leader. You suddenly need some rules. If you're like me, you don't like rules, but other people really want to know their vacation dates, really want to make sure they're being paid every month. And you may not care, but suddenly you have employees who do.
Yeah.
More than that, a lot of times people start with partners.
Hmm.
And they're like, oh, this is great. It's my best friend. It's my spouse. It's my brother.
It can be trouble.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
The problem is that's great when everything's going well. What happens when one person wants a lifestyle business and one wants to make it really big?
Yeah.
Or one is done or really doesn't have the skills to get to the next phase. So I always say that one of my lessons for entrepreneurs that are starting with partners is to get a startup prenup. And it sounds crazy, but really, if you spell everything out when everyone's getting along, then when the trouble hits, you have a plan already to how to deal with it.
Mm, that's good advice. You mentioned earlier that you have helped start 1,700 entrepreneurs.
They've started on their own.
That's right. Have the profile of those individuals changed since you started 21 years ago?
Yes, and I would say three things have happened. First of all, the number of women has grown, which I think is fantastic. So now about 20 to 25% of the companies we're seeing are led by women, which contrasts that with 8% of venture-backed companies here in the United States are started by women. Actually, the number of women is greatest in the Middle East in terms of entrepreneurs.
Interesting.
And they're amazing. One of the largest e-commerce companies, Mum's World, is headed by this incredible entrepreneur named Mona Ataya, over $150 million hair care company in Brazil, Leila Velez. So the number of women has increased. The other thing is it used to be a lot of family businesses, and now we're actually seeing the promise of technology to change industries from scratch. So we're seeing a lot more young people starting out without any family business, which is helpful because just their ideas to start out with. But the other thing is we used to see a divide between technology companies and traditional manufacturing companies. And that's really gone away as health tech and ag tech and ed tech and food tech. What people are doing is solving basic problems, but using technology as an enabler. So technology isn't the be-all, end-all. It's not just a software product or a hardware product,
mm-hmm.
but they're using technology to save lives and change lives.
Mm-hmm. I had Andrew Yang, the CEO of Venture for America, on the show a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And much to my surprise, he said, although we talk a lot about entrepreneurship and we were kind of in a free agent nation, that the number of new businesses being started in America is actually quite low. Entrepreneurship is at a historic low. So it is so good to hear that Endeavor Global is now operating in the United States, something I suspect you would have never imagined when you started. Tell us where you're at and what you've been doing.
Yeah, I was skeptical initially. I thought, the United States, who needs us? We have role models. And people said, no, but if you're outside the coasts, you don't have examples of companies that have started and scaled. They've been told if they want to scale, they've got to move to Silicon Valley or New York.
Yeah.
And we don't want the brain drain. So we want people to scale here, and we'd love your help. So we started in Miami 5 years ago. Now Endeavor's operating also in Detroit, Louisville, Atlanta. We just started in Puerto Rico, and we're starting in Northwest Arkansas.
Fantastic.
Which is where Walmart is.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very excited about the ability of companies to not only start in these cities, but to actually stay local, keep jobs, and keep their families there, and still have access to capital and mentorship and role models. And so that is what we're doing. The one thing I would say about your earlier point that you don't see, or Andrew Yang was saying he sees less examples of entrepreneurs, I actually think that the definition of entrepreneur has sort of changed, or at least not the definition, but the profile.
Mm-hmm.
I think we think of the young Steve Jobs in the garage, or the Google guys, right? And just fresh out of school, or Mark Zuckerberg in Harvard. And now you have a lot of baby boomers that are starting new careers as entrepreneurs. People, a lot of women who maybe decided to stay at home and raise their kids, and now they're actually going back to work doing their own thing. So I actually think that one of the encouraging things is, when I was starting out, the reason I wrote Crazy as a Compliment is people said, I don't look like an entrepreneur. No one's going to trust me. And if I don't, you know, have an engineering degree and wear a black turtleneck, I can't be this, you know, this great thing. And I said, no, all you need is an idea and the ability to, like, move forward with it. And so I actually see a lot more entrepreneurship. I just think it's in unexpected places.
Mm-hmm.
And by people, we don't necessarily associate with the word.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting when you talked about the poll before. In these cities in the United States, people want you there, don't they?
Yeah, they want us there. You're seeing, you know, Steve Case with his Rise of the Rest.
That's exactly
talking
right.
About
yeah.
It. I think that we're going to see an explosion of entrepreneurship around cities that you haven't heard of in the next 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening already. It's just, I think the media is going to become aware of it.
Endeavor Global is a nonprofit organization, and you, of course, are very familiar with the sector. Do you believe that nonprofits, generally speaking, are being entrepreneurial as they need to be to thrive in the 21st century and really tackle the problems they're charged with addressing?
Well, I come at this somewhat differently, which is, I don't think the divide between nonprofit and for-profit makes any sense anymore.
Yep.
First of all, I always hated the term nonprofit.
Yeah,
it's
negative. A negative way.
Yeah, really. Come on.
Doesn't assert
exactly.
Who you are.
Absolutely.
And state who you're not.
Exactly. Why divide? I mean, we need rebranding. So I talk a lot early on about, we didn't have maybe financial equity tools, but we had psychic equity tools,
mm-hmm.
right, to attract people. Well, that's changed, because if you're a business today and you don't have the psychic equity and you're not pursuing some sort of social good and you can't show the impact on your stakeholders beyond your shareholders, guess what? You're not attracting millennials to your company, and you're not attracting consumers.
Mm-hmm.
So they've had no choice in the private sector but to move towards the Warby Parker and the, you know, the people who have a mission embedded in their work. And similarly, the traditional, you know, 501c3 nonprofit, it's not enough to say, oh, you have a mission, you can do good, because now you're competing with that private sector.
That's right.
You have to offer people job growth, you have to offer stimulation, you have to offer impact, and you have to offer financial rewards. So I actually see these hybrid models like Endeavor. We have the traditional nonprofit with the mentorship model, and then we have these co-investment funds. Blended models really taking root. And in fact, I freaked out my board when I started calling us this hybrid. And they're like, what do you mean? Hybrid? We don't like that word. You need another word. So I said, okay. So I went back and I came back to the next board meeting. I said, guys, I've got it. Facebook today has 71 gender options. 71. We are beyond the binary here, people. So just like there's no male-female binary anymore, there's no for-profit, non-profit binary anymore. We're progressive. We're forward-looking. We are a trans-profit.
That's great.
George said, we think hybrid works after all.
Yeah, sounding good all of a sudden. Absolutely.
But I think that, to your broader point, I think that if not traditional nonprofits aren't moving forward, aren't taking risk, aren't disrupting themselves, and aren't giving young people the opportunity to move ahead to have incentive plans, they're not going to be able to attract the workers of the future.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Well, let me pick up from that. Endeavor Global is a great place to work. I mean, your Glassdoor scores are off the charts, and I know these healthy corporate cultures don't happen by accident. They're quite intentional. Tell us about some of the things you've done to create a positive and empowering workplace culture at Endeavor.
Well, one of the best things I did was to recruit Fernando Fabre to be our global president. He had been one of our top managing directors, and he came now 9 years ago to become president. And that was really important because I was the entrepreneur, and I always wanted to empower people. But I thought my style was, which was when people asked, when's our vacation? I would answer, whenever you want it to be. I thought that was fantastic. Apparently, they were frustrated. They wanted to know exactly what vacation days they had between Christmas and New Year's. And I didn't even understand the question, right? So Fernando is very complimentary to me. And he, I call him Mr. KPI, which he doesn't like so much sometimes. But he has really established what are people's goals and how, and they're going to get feedback and they're going to know their vacation days and know what's expected of them. So he fills that side of the equation where they know they're going to be, you know, what they're judged on and they know how they can move forward. And then for me, I have the spirit of ideas can come from anywhere. You can challenge me. You can challenge anyone. And so what we hear is it's that combination, right? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes if you only have the rules or if you only have the kind of chaotic
free for all,
yeah. That doesn't work so well. So I would say to people, find your complement and then build from there.
You're a trans management team.
Exactly. Hermaphroditic, maybe.
Let me close with this, Linda. You know, there are a number of people who have this entrepreneurial spirit somewhere inside of them, but somehow can never really tap it and let it out. What are the things that hold people back, and is there something they can do about it?
Yeah, you know, that's an excellent question. I've said that I believe the best entrepreneurial ideas don't die in the marketplace or in the laboratory. They die in the shower. And I think even if you're inside a corporation, I believe in the power of intrapreneurs. It's not a great word, but I believe that so many people have ideas and they, first of all, are afraid to give themselves permission. So I think that's the number one thing. You have to give yourself permission to go forward with your crazy idea and then own the fact that other people are going to call you crazy. You know, I wore Chica Loca with a badge of honor. The second thing is if you are in a workplace, I think there's a way you don't go to your boss first. Don't try to go and get the budget and get the approval first. Get the proof points. Don't do a PowerPoint. Don't do a business plan. Get the proof points. Start testing your idea. And I think that a little bit goes a long way. And if you start getting traction, if other people think your idea and what you've been thinking of is also necessary or is working, then little by little, that'll give you the courage to share it with the next person and so on. And the last thing is do not tell your family first. I think that we have the, you know, friends don't let friends drive drunk. Well, friends don't let best friends test drive their ideas because they're bound to tell you this is terrible and you'll bankrupt your family. So just don't listen to them. Go to like the Facebook friend maybe before your actual best friend.
Right. And do your napkin at Starbucks, not on your kitchen table.
Exactly. Good.
Well,
I
Lyndon
like that.
Rotenberg, the founder and CEO of Endeavor Global and author of Crazy is a Compliment, The Power of Zigging When Everyone Else Zags. Thanks so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and the information that visitors will find there.
Sure. Well, you can go to www.endeavor.org. That is spelled Endeavor the American way without the U.
Mm-hmm.
And learn all about how to become an Endeavor entrepreneur or take Endeavor to your city or country. LindaRotenberg.com is where I have my own website, and you can follow me on Twitter as well.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much, Linda. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Great to be here.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
Welcome back to The Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
The Hilton Humanitarian Prize is the world's largest annual humanitarian award and is presented to a nonprofit organization judged to have made an extraordinary contribution toward alleviating human suffering. There have only been 22 ever awarded, and only one to an organization that addresses mental illness. That organization is Fountain House. And it's a pleasure to have with us the executive director of Fountain House, Kenneth Dudek. Good evening, Ken, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
It's great to be here.
Let's start on the steps of the New York Public Library back in the 1940s and share with listeners the founding story of Fountain House.
So basically, you had a group of people who were ex-patients from Rockland State Hospital, seven ex-patients from Rockland State Hospital, and they got together and they formed a group that was called WANA, which stands for We Are Not Alone.
Hmm.
And the WANA group then hooked up with two volunteers. One of them was Elizabeth Skirmerhorn,
yeah,
very, very famous New York name, and the other one was Hetty Richard. And between the two volunteers and the seven people, they formed a social program, and they bought a building on West 47th Street in Hell's Kitchen, where we are to this day, 70 years later, actually.
And the story behind Fountain?
It's not complicated.
I know.
People want it to be more than what it is, but basically in the backyard of the original building that was Fountain House, there was a fountain, and that was it. That's all there is to it. There is no water imagery or anything like that.
Well, you're a very practical and logical organization, and now I know where it started.
Yeah.
Let us take a step back, Ken. What is mental illness? How is it defined, and what does it include?
So mental illness covers a wide scope of emotional and thinking disorders, let's say. And the ones that Fountain House focuses on are the most serious illnesses of schizophrenia and bipolar and serious depression as well. And so schizophrenia is really a thinking disorder, and bipolar is really an emotional disorder or a disorder of emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, that's a simple definition of what it is. It's what people used to refer to in the old days when they would say that people were having a nervous breakdown. I think in the most, I once attended a conference on stigma, and they did all this research about what was the most acceptable term around this illnesses, and they found out that nervous breakdown was a very old-fashioned term. Basically, it's people who used to spend time in state mental hospitals for many, many years, and nowadays no one does that anymore, or very few people do. And it's an illness which, with the right kind of support and treatment, people do reasonably well in the community.
Mm-hmm. What percentage of the population in this country has some sort of mental illness?
So the common statistic is 1 in 4. If you're looking at the most serious illnesses like schizophrenia, it's 1% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about that 1% is on schizophrenia is that's around the world, that basically there is 1% of, in every country, in every socioeconomic status, there is 1% of the people with schizophrenia. And on bipolar, it's about 3 to 4% of the population. And so the World Health Organization says that basically there are 450 million people around the world who have mental health issues of one type or another.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to be doing a conference with them coming up, aren't you?
Yeah. So in the fall, we've partnered up with the World Health Organization, with Grand Challenges Canada, with Cities Rise, with a division of Columbia University, and we're putting on a conference basically to look at the issue of early mortality of people with serious mental illness, because unfortunately people with serious mental illness die as early as 25 years earlier than most people do.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it is. It's unbelievable, really. And, you know, at Fountain House, we live in a community of people. There are many people at Fountain House. There's 1,500 people a year at Fountain House. And so we see people who we know very well who die at a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, we have a memorial project that we kind of do. And so for us, this is a very real issue. This is not like some kind of statistic out there in the world.
Yeah.
This is about people that we know and love. And so we're very invested in trying to make that better.
Man, that really hits home.
Yeah.
You know, we've had several guests on the show involved in the criminal justice system, and they've made the point that prison is a far too common answer for dealing with a mental health crisis in this country. Do you know how many of those people serving time in jail have some kind of mental disorder?
You know, I don't know the number. The most tragic number I've ever heard. Now, I've been working in the field of community mental health for about 35, 40 years. And the number that was the most disappointing to me was that I found out that the number of people in jails and prisons who have mental health issues is about the same number of people who used to be in the state hospitals back in the 50s.
Mm.
And so that, to me, was very disturbing. And clearly what's happened is there's been a failure in the deinstitutionalization movement of closing the state hospitals, because a lot of those people have ended up in jail and prison, and that's really unfortunate, or homeless.
The Fountain House Clubhouse International model, and you can get to Clubhouse International and explain to us what it is in a moment, has been tremendously admired and replicated across the world. How does it work, and what is the underlying philosophy?
So I've come to a new way of describing it. When someone has a serious mental illness, they basically need three things to really do well and to grow and to live in the community. So the three things are good psychiatric care, which I would describe as primarily medication with a little bit of therapy, then good medical care, which is the thing we were talking about earlier on the health thing, and then the third thing is something that in the public health sector they refer to as social determinants of health, which is basically, you know, the rest of your life, essentially. In Fountain House, we translate that into work and housing and education. And so I really, so that to me, the biggest problem for people with serious mental illness in this day and age is isolation.
Mm.
That what happens to people is that they live in the community, but they are really totally isolated from the community, and that's not a good thing.
How does community work as therapy?
So basically, the entire community of Fountain House is structured as a place where you come. It's a community center. The house in Fountain House doesn't reflect housing. It actually reflects, we come out of the settlement house movement.
Mm-hmm.
So we are like a place, and settlement houses were places that helped new immigrants in the country to settle into the United States. Well, Fountain House was formed as a place to help the people coming out of those state hospitals to settle back into the community. So what we did was we created this center on 47th Street where people come every day if they choose. It's all voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
And they participate in the activities of the house. They help run the house. So the house is partially run by the members as well as a professional staff. And in exchange for that, we help the members get jobs, go to school, find a place to live, basically whatever they need in order to be able to survive in the community and thrive in the community, actually, become kind of citizens of the country.
Yeah, so you kind of really focus on their strengths and abilities and not on their illness.
Yep. So we have a special relationship with a place called the Bear Center, which is a clinic, which it provides the psychiatric services that I described and the medical part of it. So at Fountain House, so we believe in that the illness is real, and that people need to take the medication. On the other hand, what we know, what's going to help somebody in their recovery and their rehabilitation is to really be an active participant and to do something. And the way you do that is you build on people's strengths. John Beard, who was the original director of Fountain House, basically used to say, if I can find a healthy thumbnail, I can make it work from there. And I believe that's really one of the great strengths of the Fountain House community approach, in that it's sometimes you think it's going to be the big things like get a job or go to school or get a house. It often is not the beginning of somebody's rehabilitation. Oftentimes it's when somebody decides they're just going to help out a little bit. And they see some other people helping out and they say, you know, I'm going to do that. Because one of the terrible things about this illness is it basically takes away from your self-esteem.
Yeah.
It makes you feel like you're worthless.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing I think that we're always about is saying, listen, we're going to show you that you are a worthwhile person and you have a lot to contribute. And that really begins people's recovery. And then they start making other kind of connections and they're able to move on. But I believe very strongly in the idea that people have to have a place to come to. They have to have this kind of community center. Because if people don't have that, it's very difficult to coordinate all the activities that people have in their lives. And if you always know as the member that there's this place that I can go to and they're going to help me with whatever the thing is I need help with, that's always going to make a big difference. You know, fragmented services in mental health have existed my entire career.
Mm-hmm.
And people keep coming up with different formulas for how they're going to organize that. But oftentimes it comes from a kind of a government level, right? State, city. And they're saying, we're going to have a good structure. Here's the structure. We have one of these. We have one of these. But if you're the person on the bottom looking up and you're saying, well, I got to go over to Broadway to get this, I got to go over to the east side to get that, it's not going to happen, first of all, but it also is very confusing to people. Whereas if I know I can go to Hell's Kitchen, to 47th Street, to Fountain House, and they're going to help me with the things I need help with, that's clearer. So I think what needs to happen in New York City and in lots of places is there have to be many more programs like Fountain House so that people know where to go, where to get the help.
No, people need to be needed. There's no question about it.
Yes.
Speaking about a lot more, let's talk a little bit about Clubhouse International.
Yeah, sure.
Who are they?
So Fountain House is the original Clubhouse for many years. And then over time, we received a training grant from the National Institute of Mental Health. So many new programs were developed. There are 300 around the world. And then there came a moment when a lot of those programs really wanted to have a voice in all the work that we were doing. So we all jointly formed this organization together. It had a different name in the beginning, but now it's called Clubhouse International. And a lot of what they do now is they do the accreditation, because quality became a really big issue for us in terms of the developing of programs. And there are 300 Clubhouses that we in Clubhouse International claim. There probably are 1,000 places in the country who invoke Fountain House's name or other places. So it becomes an issue sometimes for us because people get very confused about our message and who we are. Mm-hmm. So we've tried to really work on the quality issue of the programming.
You spoke a moment ago about employment, and I think it's about 15% of people with mental illness are employed in this country. What would that number be for the members of Fountain House?
It's a little between 40 and 60%, depending on who you're talking about. We have a very extensive employment program. We're known for developing one particular, those who know us from our old days, if you will, know us as the people who developed transitional employment, which is one technique for helping people go to work. But since then, we have all kinds of variations. We have supported employment, which is a kind of a more permanent situation. But the latest thing that we're into is we've been doing these social enterprises where we've been forming these businesses, and with the members themselves being the primary owners of the businesses and with our kind of added support behind them. And so we have a delivery service called Jackrabbit.
Mm-hmm.
We have a catering company called Clever Cheetah. You'll notice the animal theme going on here. Yeah. And so we have a bunch. And, you know, we initially started off using one. We've been doing it about 7 years now. We started with one formula, which didn't work for us. And now we found a really good formula that works really, really well. And so I'd say we have about 5 businesses, and we probably in that grouping have 40 people that are working. And it's been a really, it's had lots of different benefits that work for us. So we're very committed to employment because we know that even when people are working part-time, it immediately impacts their recovery and their rehabilitation. You can see it. You can physically see people change when they go to work. It's really incredible to watch that.
I bet it is. And it's a very thoughtful program. You even have an absentee coverage program. So if one
on transitional employment, which is still one of our core programs and one that I believe deeply in, it's particularly good for people who have had no work history, which a lot of our people haven't. And so in order to help people in the beginning, we basically tell the employer that we will guarantee the job. So the first person to go in to train is a social worker from Fountain House who learns the job, and then they're the teacher of the person who goes on the job, and then the member comes in as part of that mix. And so, yes, so that's one of the great guarantees we make on the transitional employment program, that we will cover the job. I personally have worked TE jobs. I used to work for Broadridge. I used to drive out to Long Island once a week and with a group of people, and we used to do some proxy sorting, actually.
You know, you had a startling statistic before saying that the life expectancy of somebody with mental illness can be as much as 25 years shorter than average. I can only imagine that health and wellness are quite important at Fountain House. Tell us about some of those programs.
So about 10 years ago, maybe, we started really focusing on this issue because it's an interesting thing. For many years, people with serious mental illness, the people didn't pay as much attention to their health because their other mental health issues were pretty serious. Actually, what happened to us, as I said to you, we're kind of a community of people. So when things happen in our community, we pay attention. We had 4 people die who were under the age of 40 in a very short period of time, like within a month or 2 months. And it just shock their whole community. And so we just started paying attention to the issue. So we started a grouping. We ended up having an entire center now. The top of our building is the Adam and Peter Lewis Wellness Center.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Lewis was the founder of Progressive Insurance. Flow to those of who know the commercials. And Peter and Adam gave us this money. We have a gym in our building. At Fountain House, we have like many floors, and each floor has two functions. They support the members who work within that floor, and they have a function for the entire house. So the wellness unit's function is to pay attention to the wellness of all the members of Fountain House. And then we also do linkages with the Bear Center, which is where the primary care doc is, as well as we're about to have a race, which I guess I would be remiss to not point out. We have what we refer to as the 1 in 4 5K. The 1 in 4 is, of course, the number of people with mental illness in the country. And it's going to be on April 7th on Saturday in the Riverside Park. If you just go to our website, you can see all the information about it. We welcome everybody to come and walk and run with us. We're as many walkers as runners, so don't be afraid if you're not a runner. It's a good place to come. I'll be there. Actually, oftentimes Gail Brewer is there. She's a remarkable person. She comes out to these. She's been to 2-3 of our things.
Yeah.
And it's April 7th is not always the warmest day of the year,
Not this year.
No.
Going.
Yes. May have to bring your snow skis this year.
Never know. Fifth Northeastern may be on the way for all we know. So, I should add, too, is that when these members come to Fountain House, and it is all voluntary, as you said before, they pick a unit, don't they, in which to work. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah. So a member joins, and the criteria for membership at Fountain House is basically that you have a serious mental illness and you want to join Fountain House, and you have, at least some thought about moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be a big thought. And then you come into Fountain House, and there basically you get a tour. You get to join one of 7 units in Fountain House. And that's basically your home base within Fountain House, because Fountain House itself is fairly large. It's about 60,000 square feet, so it's a big place. And then once the member joins that place, that unit, they basically then also get to pick their own worker. There tend to be about 5 social workers attached to every unit within Fountain House, each of which has a group of members that they work with. And so, and then once you've picked that worker and then you start working on your task, every unit has abilities to get you into the jobs, into the housing. You don't have to go to another place in Fountain House.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have your worker and you have your unit, they're going to help you go basically any place you want to go and get whatever you need to do.
Mm-hmm. Have you conducted studies or have others that measure the effectiveness of Fountain House and Clubhouse International model?
I have 2 answers to this. I and Fountain House are completely committed to doing much more research on this subject to show the efficacy of different things, not just the efficacy of the Fountain House model, but the idea of that social determinants are going to make a big difference in people's life. There's more and more research in other illnesses as well as mental illness that the social determinants of people's lives have a big impact on their health. And you can reduce the cost of health care if you focus on those things. Second thing is the NYU did a study for us around the issue of hospitalization, because this is in the new managed care world, issues of hospitalization and emergency room use have become a very big deal. So basically what we found is that Fountain House, for people who were heavily using the system before, which means they were in the hospital a lot, they were using emergency rooms a lot, we were able to reduce that by 21%, which is a fairly significant number.
Sure is.
Yeah. So we are, and we believe that if we can do this in combination with the Bear Center, where we have some sense of the psychiatric coverage and the medical coverage, we can expand that number even more. We have 4 other studies going on connected to Fountain House. Some of them are qualitative studies and some of them are quantitative studies. It's hard sometimes to do the quantitative studies in our work, but we're very committed to doing it. We've adapted a model a little bit like NARSAD. I'm not sure NARSAD has where we fund a researcher at a university who's interested in some topic that's of interest to Fountain House. So, for example, right now we have some researchers from Yale who are doing a study on loneliness, which is their twist on the social isolation story. And they have a whole explanation of why loneliness as opposed to isolation. But so that's really important to us because we know for our members, and, you know, we pick topics that we know our membership really cares about or Fountain House the Larger cares about. And those are the kind of things we're looking at.
Let's turn to funding. You know, you hear many in the context of some of these tragic school shootings that it's not a gun issue, but a mental health issue. So the question I have for you, Ken, is what is the investment that the federal, local, state government is making towards mental health?
Well, I think there's not adequate funding for mental health. On the other hand, I would say to you, the other problem I see is that the money that is being spent on mental health doesn't match the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Where the money's being spent doesn't quite match what the issues are. So when people say there's a problem with people with serious mental illness, they're going in the hospitals too much, they're homeless, they're in the jails.
Yeah.
So well, then you would think the money to support those people would reflect, that would be connected to those issues. It's not often connected to those issues, and it's not often the thing that somebody needs.
Where's it going?
You know, it goes to other kinds of mental health issues, which are, you know, I would never say that those things are not worthwhile, but I'm a person who focuses on people with serious mental illness. A lot of the people that people talk about when they're talking about homeless and jails, and that's people with serious mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's not enough funds that get into that grouping in a good way. You and I were having a conversation earlier about how we've been stuck at 300 clubhouses in our development. And people have always said to me when they come to Fountain House, they say, this is a wonderful place. How come there aren't more of these places in the world? And, you know, I've been hearing that for so many years. I finally have a really good answer. The real reason there aren't more places like Fountain House is because of the government funding streams. There is not adequate funding streams for places like Fountain House. And there's not, they don't come in a way that make it easy for people to use. Medicaid is a perfect example, right? Medicaid is the biggest funder of public, you know, health in the country, but it doesn't work very easily for places like Fountain House. Although there are places throughout the country who make some of that work, it's always kind of jury-rigging the thing. It's always, you know. So what I believe is if we could figure out a way to get Medicaid into a kind of a case rate system, that would work really well for both the members of Fountain House and the members of other places around the country, and would actually support the things that are necessary. Because Medicaid will pay enough, I mean, some people would argue not enough, but they will pay for the psychiatric care, they'll pay for the medical care. But when it comes to the social determinants, there's not a lot of funding available for that. And, you know, I think that that's the future. And now New York State has been trying to make this work, you know, and I think that there's some initiatives that they have going on right now, which may end up with something good, but I don't know right now. I'm not 100% sure. The thing I'm very clear about is if people want more places like Fountain House, they have to address this issue of funding, because if that's really what makes a big difference. Fountain House itself is able to do a lot of its innovative work because we raise a lot of money privately. But I don't know that that's a formula for the expansion of programs throughout the country. I actually think that every not-for-profit like Fountain House should raise a certain amount of private money, but I think it should be supplementary to the government funding of the base of the program. And so that's what I think about it.
Yeah, I think to get any kind of real leverage and scale, the government has to be involved
in a very
meaningful way.
Yeah.
There's no question about
that. And I think there's a lot of foundations and individuals who are interested in the innovative parts of the work always. But it's hard to get the money for the general operation of I think that's true for many, many social service programs.
Let me close with this, Ken.
Yeah.
Do you believe that we as a society are making any progress in removing the stigma around mental illness? And what things would you like to see happen to move the needle faster on that?
What I believe about this is that more people who are connected. So remember the 1 in 4 statistic, right? So that's 1 in 4 people who have the illness. So then if you extrapolate that to their families, you're looking at a very large number of people who know these illnesses, right?
Yep.
Who are exposed to these illnesses. But because of the prejudice of it, you know, there's this very big prejudice against these particular illnesses that are unique to other things. So what I believe is the more people who speak out about this, the better it will be. And that the more we are able to expose our membership to the world so that people know them as people, it will immediately, it goes right at the issue, if you will. I think some of the larger campaigns, some of which I've been a part of, have an impact, but the biggest impact is always going to be as people know people and people are more open. I think that bipolar in particular has made some great strides in the last 10 years or more. I think schizophrenia is still the bad one that people that we need to overcome, and it's you know, it's too scary to people, and it shouldn't be scary to people. You know, I have spent my entire life with people with schizophrenia and bipolar, and I'm here to tell you, you know, that they are a great group of people. That's the reason I do this work. It is a remarkable, resilient group of people. I mean, if I had been knocked down as much as some of our members have been knocked down, I'm not sure I could get up again. Mm-hmm. But this group of people, they get up every day. They want to go to work. They want to go to school. And, you know, it's just an incredible group of people.
That's a great note to end on. Yep. End on. Well, Kenneth Dudek, the executive director of Fountain House, I want to thank you so much for coming in this evening. Tell us about your website and the kind of information you provide there.
So it's easy. You can just go to www.fountainhouse.org, and you can learn as much, a lot about Fountain House, and you can see any of our activities that are coming up, like the 1 in 4 5K or the conference in the fall. And, you know, you can get to learn more about us. And if you want to, and then there is a link there also to Clubhouse International. So if you have an interest in other places in the country, that's another good way to do it. And that's pretty much it.
Well, thank you very much, Ken. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
And that is this week's show. Next week, you're going to hear from journalist, angel investor, and philanthropist Esther Dyson about her latest initiative in healthcare called Wellville. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.